Good morning. Welcome to what is, I expect, the last of the Medical Halacha series for this year. There we go.
Hebrew year. Hebrew year, sure.
Sorry?
The Hebrew year.
Right, well, that's the idea. I expect to be in Israel in August. I forgot to start this thing. Let's see. I think just this is fine. There we go. Okay, so I expect this is the last of the Medical Halacha series for this year. I want to thank Laser for coordinating all year long, and God willing, next year as well. That's what they call an assumptive close in the negotiating business, right? And I also want to say, as I say at every one of these, that that what I'm going to say this morning is not intended. You know, if someone could get the door, please. Is not intended as psak. You know, as always, please see your shul rabbi to provide you with guidance on the matter in a practical way. If anyone here is pregnant, I think for most people here, I think the assumption is not. But nonetheless, on practical matters, please do see your shul rabbi. Oh, and for the refreshments this morning, thank you very much, Laser. So, in dealing with the topic of fasting during pregnancy, we need to answer certain questions. The first question is, what are the relevant medical concerns? What exactly could come up? And I did some research, and you can see there on the sheet some of the papers that I looked at. That's some of what's out there. It's interesting to note how many of the papers are actually about Ramadan. You don't have too many papers about, well, any that I could find about, like, Yom Kippur. Their numbers are somewhat greater than ours, number one. And number two, they're fasting for a month, where we're fasting for a day, and therefore the concern for damage is much higher in their case.
But there's a completely different concept.
Oh, yeah.
They only fast during the day. They could eat as much as they want.
Correct. Correct. The immediate intense effect is greater in ours. The sheets are at the end. On the other hand, in terms of a build-up effect, you know, you're going to see it by them. You're not going to see it for us. But one is we have to define the medical risks. Once we do that, we then need to define our terms in terms of the question of fasting during pregnancy. We need to answer the question of what are the relevant halachic considerations? How does the halacha view the health of a pregnant woman, the health of the fetus? How do we define pregnancy altogether? And what exactly is the nature of these fasting obligations? Once we've defined what the fast is, once we've defined what pregnancy is, once we've defined how we look at the seriousness of the health of a pregnant mother and her child, then we could actually approach the question of, okay, so what do we do? So under the medical risks, you see I listed on your sheet the concerns that I could find listed in the literature. Again, the studies tend to be on the Ramadan fasters, and that's not necessarily a sign that translates into the Jewish one day or even night into a day fast. The first concern that I saw was for lower glucose levels and poor fetal nutrition. It seems, based on what I've read, and you know, a lot of physicians here. Oh,
that was nice. Let's try that again. Let's see if we
got that to work. You know, I think I did that before. All right, so it's starting now. Fine. Again, under the category of the medical risks of fasting during pregnancy, the first concern is for lowered glucose levels and weakened nutrition. So the mother's health, based on what I've read, doesn't seem to suffer. In a fast, assuming she's healthy going in, and assuming she has normal fat stores, it's true that the lack of glucose is going to lead the body at some level to metabolize fat, breaking down lipids in her system to produce the energy substrates. But in a normal healthy case, she shouldn't suffer from the lowered glucose level. I'm not dealing with a diabetic. I'm not dealing with some of the issues that can come up, which will take her out of normal health. What about poor fetal nutrition? So what I've seen in the studies is that there is a possibility late in the pregnancy for problems as a result of this. But they did a study from 1964 to 1984 of 13,000 babies born during Ramadan, and they found that it had no effect on the mean birth rate. Birth weight, I should say, at whatever stage of pregnancy this occurred. They did note some women in late pregnancy had lower glucose levels, they said, well, gee, maybe this might be cause for concern. But overall, they didn't seem terribly concerned. They did note as well a possibility of lower amino acid levels. But no one that I saw discussed this having a real impact on the fetus. I also saw a discussion about ketone production. When the body breaks down fats, it produces ketones, which do cross the placenta. And, sorry?
Muscle, no. Ketones are from muscle metabolism.
Yeah? I thought it was from I'm going to mispronounce this, lipolysis. That's what I saw. Sorry? Okay. We have a machlokes harufin. But one of the concerns that I saw is that they do cross the placenta and they're metabolized by the fetus. And there was some concern that that might not be healthy. And also ketones tend to lower the pH and therefore you run a risk of acidosis. So that I did see mentioned. But I'm not sure because that came from a Ramadan set of fasts. That's a month-long process, not a one-day process. I'm not sure how that translates. Much greater concerns develop when you deal with hydration issues. There's concern for fetal dehydration. I saw a study that was done in southern Israel where they said this had nothing to do with fasts. It had to do with just generally women who are pregnant during the summertime needing to drink 10 glasses of water a day just to avoid fetal dehydration. And I saw a related concern and this is a word that is hard to pronounce, but I think I got it, oligohydramnios, which is the reduction of amniotic fluid. Yeah, that was pretty good, no? But this is actually probably the most serious concern that I saw raised. And basically, the amniotic fluid plays many practical roles. It cushions the baby from pressure against the uterus and from shock. It provides heat insulation for the fetus as well. It is involved also in muscular, skeletal, and lung development. If a woman goes into labor with reduced amniotic fluid, there's a concern for cord compression. And there's concern for preterm labor late in the pregnancy. Is this impacted by fasting? So it's definitely impacted by the mother's hydration level. Fluid that would have gone for the amniotic sac is diverted to prevent maternal and fetal dehydration. But it's, again, not clear how much of that will happen in one day of fasting, assuming she's normally hydrated going in. They found in studies that there is no effect on premature birth, and they did studies through Ramadan and found that there was no effect on it, which was very interesting. And they did these multi-year studies to see the rates of early births and the rates of stillbirths, multiple births, C-sections, and the like, and they found no significant statistical difference.
And I heard that, like in Israel, you know, like the hospitals are completely overjammed right after Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur.
Yeah, you know, right. So I heard that too, and the studies don't. I've heard that. I even heard that there were studies done, and I went looking for them, and I can't find any studies that actually show that. I find studies done on thousands and thousands of Ramadan kids. When I say thousands and thousands, I mean that literally. And they find no statistical difference in how long the gestation is. One thing they did note that was very interesting regarding Ramadan, I don't know if it's an analog for us, is that 9 months before Ramadan is the period right after the Hajj. And they did find an increased rate of births during Ramadan, but they said it's not about fasting triggering birth. It's about the fact that after the Hajj, they've been very pious and they're committed to building the family, and then after that, then they conceive, and so 9 months later they have a birth. But that it wasn't about but when they checked, they found that these babies were not being born prematurely. So it's another, you know, separate cause. Yeah, it was a fascinating issue. But the concern for premature birth does have scientific basis to it. First, because when you have when someone is fasting, that can lower in general the blood level, and the concern is that you'll have higher concentration of oxytocin. And the result of that, am I pronouncing that right? I hope I got the chemical name right. No, I'm not. Oxytocin, thank you. I'm glad that you tell me now and not after I said it 10 times. there's a concern for a higher concentration of oxytocin, which can trigger contractions. That triggers the muscles in the uterus to contract. And so theoretically, you could, you know, cause a woman to go into labor that way. The hydration has actually been proposed as a treatment for women with preterm labor issues. Although studies have found that giving women who are normally hydrated additional fluid intravenously does not reduce the incidence of preterm labor. There's a separate concern that you always have to keep in mind for outliers, for women who aren't in the normal statistical set. A woman who has, pregnancy-related diabetes is going to be an entirely different category. That's not who we're talking about in this. A woman dealing with a case of intrauterine growth restriction where the child doesn't have the normal space needed to develop, and therefore you have greater concern for the amniotic fluid, is also not going to be within this this scenario. But those are the concerns that I found as listed there on your sheet, and you can see the studies there. To support it. Those are concerns that I found that figure into the medical risks that are involved. Some of them are a more direct risk to the fetus. Some of them are about preterm labor. In general, as I said at the beginning, there seems to be less concern that this is actually going to harm the mother in a serious way. So let's move to the next phase. How exactly do we view the pregnant woman and the fetus within halacha? Now that we've defined that there are certain medical risks, even though we haven't presented anything definitive, how would we view the mother's health and how do we view the fetus's health? So there are three key gemara that you need to look at very quick. First, source number one, Mishnah and Yoma. If a pregnant woman smells food, and the idea is not simply that she smelled food, but she develops a serious craving, such that you're afraid that it's going to damage her health, damage her life even, to not eat food. So we feed her until her life is restored. This is talking about Yom Kippur. Now, mind you, the Mishnah and Gemara really view this as a pikuach nefesh situation. It isn't just she's going to suffer mentally and emotionally by not eating. This was actually considered to be a life and death scenario. Now, the Gemara goes on there to tell us how you feed her. It isn't that you just automatically say, okay, here's a hamburger. First you try to whisper in her ear that it's Yom Kippur, and if that doesn't work, then you give her some little taste of something and so on until you see that she's satisfied. But we do see that even for Yom Kippur, the De'oraisa among fasts, there is the possibility of overriding it for the sake of her health. Take a look at source number two, which takes us a step further, not in terms of fasting, but in terms of protecting a fetus. We're not going to go into the whole issue of contraception in general. Suffice it to say for the moment that as a general rule, contraception, direct act of contraception, would be prohibited in Judaism. That's what I'm going to take now. It is nowhere near as clear a topic as all that, but that's what I'm going to say to oversimplify it for the sake of this source. The Shalosh Nashim Mishamshot B'moch, says the Gemara in Ksubos. There are three women who are permitted to use contraception. Moch is specifically an obstacle which will prevent the seed from getting in. Eluhein, and these are the three women who can do that. Ketana, a minor. Umeuberes, a woman who is already pregnant. Umenika, and a woman who is nursing. Ketana shematis aber, the minor, because you are concerned she might become pregnant and she's not able to carry the pregnancy to term, betamos, and she might die. So if a girl was married off as a minor, granted that the Gemara Kiddushin says you're not supposed to do that, but if it happened, she would be allowed to keep herself from becoming pregnant through the means of this moch. Meuberes, a woman who is pregnant, shematayasa ubra sandal, lest the fetus be harmed. There's a concern, and this is not necessarily borne out medically, but there's a concern that the woman is already pregnant, and now a new fetus begins to form inside. She conceives again, and that'll damage the first. The menika shematigmol esbina, and a woman who is nursing, we're concerned that she might become pregnant. We know that it can happen for a woman to become pregnant while she's nursing, and then it's going to cut off the milk, and the baby is now left without a supply of milk. That's the concern there. But the point that emerges here is the middle case. You're telling me that out of concern for the life of the fetus, we are going to permit them to engage in relations with contraception. But you told me that that's prohibited in general. The contraception is prohibited. So we see that there is a willingness to override concern for a prohibition, and a serious prohibition at that, in order to preserve the life of a fetus. So that's a very important piece in this discussion. And then we're going to come back to it. And then the third source is the Gemara Psachim. The Gemara Psachim is source number three. The regarding completing fasts, this specifically Tisha B'Av, Darash Rava, Rava taught, Ubros umenikos misanos umashlimos bo. Women who are pregnant, women who are nursing, fast and complete the fast on Tisha B'Av, Kederach shemisanos umashlimos b'Yom HaKippur, just as they do on Yom Kippur. The Gemara is equating Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. We're going to come back to that when we talk about the levels of the different fasts, but right now that's what the Gemara is saying. So we have three sources. Number one, a Gemara in Yuma that says if she's suffering on Yom Kippur and we're concerned for her life, we have her break the fast. Number two, we have a willingness to break halacha to protect the life of a fetus. And number three, we have the Gemara in Psachim that says they are supposed to be fasting on Tisha B'Av like on Yom Kippur. So far, so good. Let's break this down, though, in terms of the different concerns, because it's not so clear-cut in terms of how our concerns work, and then how they apply to the different fasts. So first of all, concern for her health. What exactly is sufficient to trigger our concern when it comes to the health of a mother? We saw already the fear that if she doesn't get some food, she's going to die on Yom Kippur. Are we concerned for a woman's pain? What if she's simply in pain? Do we say break a fast for pain? Take a look at source number four, which is going to lead us to a Mishnah Berurah. This is one of the key sources in the whole discussion. The halacha brought in Shulchan Aruch. Hakol chayav lis'anos arbat somos halalu v'asur lifrotz geder. The Shulchan Aruch lists the non-Tisha B'Av fast, the non-Yom Kippur fasts, I should say, and says that everybody is obligated to fast at these on these days, and you're not allowed to break through the barriers. And we'll talk about why they need to say that a little bit later. Hagah, the Ramah comments, Mihu, however, Ubros umenikos shemitzdaros harbe ein lehisanos. Women who are pregnant, women who are nursing, who are in great pain, he doesn't say their life is in danger, they're in great pain, they don't fast. Vafilo einon mitzdaros, and even if they are not in pain, einon mechuyavan lehisanos, they're still not obligated to fast. Elashnagu lahachmir, just that our custom is to be strict, and we're going to come back to that when we talk about the severity of the different fast days. V'davka begimel tzomos, this is specifically regarding the three fasts, meaning non-Tisha B'Av, Chorban-related fasts. Maybe I should take a second just to go over that list. I was going to do it later. But remember the fasts that we have. Tanis Esther is in a league of its own, because it's not a fast related to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We'll talk about Tanis Esther as a separate thing. Then you have three that are Beis HaMikdash related, that are lower level fasts. Shiva Aser B'Tammuz is one. Asar B'Teves is another. And Tzom Gedalia is the third. Then you have over them Tisha B'Av, and over them you have Yom Kippur. No one is discussing Bahab in these fasts. They do discuss fasts for rain, interestingly, but we might get to that at the end. We'll see. The Tanis Kalom is also not within this category. She shouldn't take the nether. But I shouldn't say that so clearly. Hang on. The Shulchan Aruch says that the Ramah says that v'davka begimol tzomos, that when we say women are not obligated to fast, that means the three fasts that are Chorban related to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, not Tisha B'Av. For that they are obligated. But Tisha B'Av v'chuyavos lahashlim, for Tisha B'Av they do need to complete the fast. So on that we see the Mishnah Berurah, source number five, when we talked about the woman being in pain. He says, "Umistabra." It is logical to say, "De uberes migri mishah shehukar havlad." That uberes, pregnant, means from the time when you can tell that she's pregnant, about 3 months in. We're going to come back to that line later. It's going to be important for us to see again. But right now, that's what he says. Just like regarding nidah laws, where we treat her as not being on a normal cycle. of bleeding anymore once you can tell that she's pregnant. He says it's possible that even after 40 days, not just 3 months, but even 40 days into the pregnancy, we would say that she's considered to be a pregnant woman who doesn't need to fast if she feels pain. And then he says, not earlier on. Earlier not, she'd be like any other woman. But he concludes by saying, if she feels weak, weakness being considered an indicator of illness coming on, then we shouldn't be strict. My point in bringing this Mishnah Berurah right now is just to show that we consider pain a significant factor for her. That's already sufficient to warrant breaking the fast. She defines pain. It's each person. It's dependent on the threshold. It's discomfort, which is not directly fast related. I should note that. Because the basis for saying that pain overrides the fast, I'm going to come back to this a little bit later, but the basis for it is the idea that rabbinic decrees were not made to create pain and were not made to be applied in situations where they would create pain. So, where there's pain built into the decree, you're being told to fast, you have to be expected to absorb that. However, if you're somebody who has abnormal migraines when you're fasting, that's a different story. Because that's not the normal effect of a fast. The normal effect of a fast is gastric. What about illness? Are we concerned for illness? The answer is yes. The Mishnah Berurah mentioned there at the end, quoting from Rav Yaakov Emden's Moreh Tzia, that in Margeshes Chulsha, if she feels ill, if she feels weak, then we're not strict. What does weak mean? So the Nishmas Avram explains weakness. This Avram Savra Avram says it means that weakness can lead to illness. That's our concern. Does that mean that a pregnant woman then is somehow considered more likely to be ill than somebody else? The answer is quite possibly. If you take a look at source number 6, Arashi and Eruvin, there's a Rashi like this in Yoma as well. Rashi actually says, Tsar Ibur, Ubros Cholos Hain. Women who are pregnant are considered automatically to be ill. I have to note, though, that this Rashi in Erevin, as well as the one in Yoma, which is on Mem Zayin Amud Aleph, Ika de Amri, both of those cases are actually descriptions of women acting as sick people act. In other words, it's not a halachic diagnosis regarding, you know, cures on Shabbos and the like. That's not the context. However, it does use the term, pregnant women are ill. That's the phrase. The Rambam seems to indicate that they are not necessarily, or I should say the Magid Mishnah commenting on the Rambam, seems to say they are not considered automatically like ill people. The Rambam writes in source number 7, Ubros umenikos misanos umashlimos petishabov, right, like we've already seen in the Gemara in Pesachim, that women who are pregnant fast for Tishabov. So the Magid Mishnah comments on that in source number 8. He says, V'davar poshudu, he says it's obvious, meaning demachil nechol ha-shebo sakana, the brackets are mine. It's obvious that you feed someone who is ill, even if he's not dangerously ill. I already knew that. Because if you were going to tell me that we only feed people if their life is in danger, why single out pregnant women? Why single out nursing women? It will be true for anybody, right? This line can't mean that we only feed them when they are in a life and death situation. Even somebody who that bracketed comment I actually inserted is wrong. Sorry. It should say the ma'chil l'me'uberes. That's really what it should have said. That we're feeding a pregnant woman who is not dangerously ill. That's what I should have written. Because if you would tell me that we only feed the pregnant woman when she is dangerously ill, why single her out at all? Right? A chola she'en bo sakana is going to fast. Right? Chola she'en bo sakana misana. E'lo kol sheken, the women who are pregnant, how much more? No, You know what? I'm not so sure. I think I was right, actually, in the way that I put it in the first place. I shouldn't have doubted myself. I'm sorry. For those who are watching on the video, you can erase the last 30 seconds. He says, I'm sorry, let's go back over the line of the Magen Mishnah, because it's an important one. He says, it is obvious that we feed a chol she'en bo sakana. Because if you were going to tell me that we only feed when they are dangerously ill, right? If that was the only time that we would feed a chola, as if the chola was dangerously ill, then you wouldn't have needed the Rambam to say, ubros umenigos misanos, that these women are supposed to fast, right? Hashta chola she'en bo sakana misane. If somebody is ill but not dangerously so, we make him fast according to what you just, you know, according to your assumption. Then a local shekin, certainly they would have to fast, and that's really the key line that I'm bringing here. That key line in the Magen Mishnah, he takes it as a given that if someone who is ill but not dangerously so has to fast, then certainly a pregnant woman would have to fast. Which means he doesn't believe that pregnant women are chol she'en bo sakana. He believes that they're on a lower level. You follow? So it's not clear that we would consider them automatically a chol she'en bo sakana. Rashi used the terms, but the Magen Mishnah is less clear. What we do see is we are concerned about pain for her, and we are concerned about the possibility of illness. In addition to that, there is concern for the sake of the fetus. Are we concerned about fetal pain? Offhand, I would have assumed not, just because we have no way to diagnose it. We don't even know what we're talking about. But there's an odd line in Rabbeinu Yeruchim, quoting the Gaonim in source number 9. This is a key source in the whole discussion about fasting during pregnancy. He says, Isha me'uberes, a woman who is pregnant, asur lehisanos, is not allowed to fast. Note the terminology, not allowed to fast. Zulasi betishabav ubiyom ha-kippurim, except tishabav and yom kippur. Why? Mishum tsa'ar havlad. Because of pain for the fetus. Kach kasvu ha-gaonim, and he says, so wrote the Gaonim. That's a remarkable statement. The truth of the matter is that this gets quoted in various tshuvos, but in one set of tshuvos in particular, the Shu'at Shaul v'Nishaul, it really sounds like he's talking about survival of the fetus. He doesn't really mean pain. What he really means is danger to the fetus's survival, to the fetus's health. Rav Elchanan Wasserman, take a look at source number 10, stressed the point about fetal health based on the Gemara that we saw in Suvos. He says, "Besefer Taras HaAdam LeRamban." In the Ramban's Taras HaAdam, a source that we're going to see in 15 later on, "Hevi Machlokes in Pikuach Nefesh De'uber Docha Yisurin." The Ramban brings a debate as to whether saving fetus's life is sufficient to violate a prohibition. Vahuva Barash Yoma, it's brought in the Rush as well. Vikasha, he says, I don't understand why this is even a question. Of course we break the law in order to save the life of a fetus. Me'acha, from our source there, the Gemara in Ksuvos about contraception. Demodu l'shamish b'moch, but be'sakanas uber. They're letting them use contraception to save the fetus. So he says, v'shem ha'nefarish l'daz ha'chol yin da'yidei she'te'asa uber sandal t'stakin gam ha'aim. He says, maybe the reason why they're concerned there is that causing her to lose this fetus could damage her health as well. If there's a miscarriage, if it emerges, there's blood, whatever the blood loss, whatever concern he's worried about, maybe it's because damaging the fetus damages the mother. Maybe that will be the alternative view. I'm not really concerned about fetal health per se. I'm only concerned about the effect it'll have on the mother's health. It's an interesting problem because those who are lenient regarding abortion, saying, well, it's not a fully formed life, are then going to have to answer, why are they going to be lenient regarding her fast, right, in order to save the life of the fetus? Rashi and Yoma also indicates that we are concerned about the life of the fetus. If you take a look at source number 11, regarding that Mishnah and Yoma where we talked about the woman who smelled food, right, and we make her eat. So he says, Uber Shei Richa, Ha Uber Me Riach Reach Tavshel. He says the kid is actually the one who's smelling the food. I don't know if there's a chemical change in her body in the bloodstream and it crosses the placenta and the kid knows, aha, food's out there. V'hum is avalo, and he's hungry for it. That's not the key point. The key point is the end. V'meina ocheles shnei'en misukanin. If she doesn't eat, both of them will be endangered. So Rashi stresses it's not just her, it's the kid as well. The Rambam uses the same language. Take a look at source number 12 regarding fasts for rain. Avru Elul Lo Nanu, if one of the early sets of fasts passes by and still there's no rain, Beis Din Gozrin Shevat Hanios Acheros Al Hatzibur, Beis Din decrees seven additional fasts, Sheni V'Hamishi V'Sheni V'Hamishi V'Sheni V'Hamishi V'Sheni, he gives you the order of the seven fasts, Monday, Thursday, dot. Ube'elu HaShevat Bilvad, and only in this set of seven fasts do we say, Ubros Umanigos Misanos, that women who are pregnant will fast those fasts for rain. Abu Bashara Taniyos, but in other fasts, Ein Ubros Umanikos Misanos, they do not. The Abu Pishain and Misanos, even though they're not fasting, Ein Ma'angos Atzman Betafnukim, they shouldn't go eat delicacies now and have a good time and say, ha, I'm pregnant, I get to eat. Ella Ochlos Vishosos, rather eat and drink. Note the last three words, those are the key. Kidei Kiyum Havlad, sufficient to maintain the child. So the concern is for the kid. Now, granted, he's also dealing with menikos, who are nursing. But still, he doesn't say the mother. He says the vlad, the tour, the bach, they bring this point as well about the health of the child. It is clear that we are concerned for the health of the child and not only for the health of the mother. This is very important.
Why only be on the three fasts? I mean, that should be an overriding concern that exists for all the fasts, including Yom Kippur.
Right, that's an interesting point. In other words, how far do we go in registering the life of the fetus?
You're saying Kedekium of blood is the principle.
Right.
Right, so the Chorah, there should not be any different. If that's ultimately the reason, mm-hmm. right, and that's a reason that should mitigate even something, even Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur.
Why?
Because we are Mechal Shabbos for a...
Let me ask, we're missing one step.
But you have to pass on the past when there's no rain even. That's more chamur than...
Well, only the last of those. The last set of fasts. But we're missing one step, which is, why are we violating the fast for the sake of this fetus? In other words, what halachic strength does the fetus have? Is this a real life?
Enough that you'd be mechal Shabbos for.
Maybe. We're going to come back to it. Hang on. When we get to source 15, we'll have the answer. If you want to look ahead, you can. But it's a very good question. Hang in there. We've said that we are concerned for the health and even the pain of the mother. We have said that we are concerned for the health of the fetus, possibly the pain as well. Last item is concern for preterm labor. And here there's a little bit of a surprise. The Baal Halachos Gedolos, right, source 13, does say, "V'lo mabaya chola," not only someone who is ill gets to eat, "ela filu isha ubra," but even if a woman is pregnant, "v'yad inan de'ilo achla mis'aker v'lada," and we know that if she wouldn't eat, the child would be uprooted, meaning the child would emerge. Okay? "Ava gav de'amrinan sabig ben kayama hu sabig nefel hu," granted, I don't know if the kid is alive in there anyway, and therefore it's only a doubt about saving a life. Shaker dami lemeitan la, it's appropriate to give to her, I added the word, le'achol, we give her food. So he is concerned, the Bahag is concerned about preterm labor. The Ramban quotes this in his Taras HaAdam, under Sakana, we'll get back to that later. However, this is the surprise, although it's not a surprise once you think about it. Yes?
According to the Bahag, he said it's something that most pregnancies, I mean, most babies are born healthy. I mean, so why is it, like, I mean, don't all care about?
No, he's saying something if, whether it'll survive the preterm labor or not. In other words, maybe preterm labor isn't so bad. That's the, but the Nishmas Avram says, studies have shown that the major concern for triggering labor is really the oxytocin issue, which is only a concern at the end of the pregnancy, in the ninth month, unless you're dealing again with a woman who has other separate health concerns. He says that's not called preterm. Right? They're not concerned. Once you hit week 36, they no longer consider this. And I don't mean this rabbinically. This is what I was always told medically. And we had with a couple of our kids, we had concerns for preterm labor when we were actually, when we were supposed to move. At one point, they made us wait through a couple of months, you know, saying, you know, there's a concern, can't take the move, don't, you know, push it off. But once we hit week 36, they said, go for it. And we said, well, what happens if the baby comes? And their answer is, mazel tov. They weren't Jewish, they didn't say mazel tov. But, but they're not concerned about it. I find that particularly fascinating because there's a whole other set of halachos regarding inducing childbirth. And generally speaking, we are against doing things to induce unless there's a medical reason to do so. We don't just induce, even though you're in the ninth month. Because we say being in labor is considered to be dangerous, and therefore you don't put yourself into a dangerous position, even though you know you're going to hit it later. So we're reticent about inducing in the ninth month, and yet for this purpose, the Nishmas Avraham says, we don't consider preterm labor to be a danger such that you would break the fast in order to avoid it. I found that to be an interesting point. Okay. We've now defined our concerns, our halachic concerns. We're concerned for the mother, we're concerned for the fetus, we're concerned for preterm labor before the ninth month as a possibility, assuming that that's actually a medical concern. Let's define pregnancy. We already saw a key source on it. We saw the Mishnah Brura back in source number 5. He said after 3 months is certainly an issue, and possibly even going back to 40 days. Rav Ovadia Yosef also brought this position. Take a look at source 14 in his Yichav Adas. He says, "Be'emes sheyesh lahakel benidon zeh gam lifnei shlosha chadashim." He says we should be lenient even before 3 months. Kol she sovelas mehakaot, as long as she is suffering from vomiting, or mechoshe rosh, or headaches, or chulsha, or weakness, or kayotze ba'ilu, and similar things. Ubifrat, and certainly, im hilach arabon yom leheriona, if it's 40 days into the pregnancy, lefiam avur, v'mesechas brachas, v'mesechas nidash, as nishlama yitziras ha'ubar, as we see in the Gemara in a couple of places, that by 40 days we consider the fetus to be formed to the point of being a fetus as opposed to just being a set of cells. So he's willing to go, certainly, with 40 days. However, the Ramban says even before 40 days. And this is that Ramban I referenced it to for you before, Laser, with your question. Source 15. The Amagav Disnan, Aisha Hamakasha Lele, Mivian Sakin, Machatchen Oso, Aver, Aver. Even though we say that if a woman is having trouble giving birth, we bring a knife and we dismember the fetus. I mean, that's harsh, but that's the wording. To save her life, once the head emerges, then we don't touch the fetus because you don't want to reject one life for another. The point is, the alma meikara lesbe mishum hatzalas nefashos. It sounds like before that, there's no issue of saving a life by saving the fetus. That's what you make it sound like there. And we've learned also, the Gemara says, it's a Mishnah, that if you end the life of a day-old child, that's considered murder. Well, davka ben yom echad, aval uber lo. The implication is it's not true regarding a fetus. Ukranami ksiv, dimishalim dimei vladas. We find in the psukim as well regarding the case of causing a woman to lose her kids. Afilu hachi, even still, le'inyan shmiras mitzvos mechalin aleha. As far as observing mitzvos, we would violate halacha in order to save the fetus. Amra Torah, why? Because the Torah says, Chalel Olav Shabbos Achas Shema Yishmor Shabbosos Harve. Right? We have the other language in the Gemara of Kadesh, Yishmor, same idea. That we would be willing to desecrate Shabbos, not only that, we're supposed to, in order to help somebody observe many Shabbatot. Hilchach, therefore, Afilu b'hatzalas uber pachos miben arboim yom, she'elo chius klal. Therefore, even in saving a fetus who is under 40 days, who has no life of a status that we could think of as life, mechal and olav, we still violate it. For him, kedas b'halachos, like the view promoted by the Bahag. So,
I think it's true for Shabbos, it's true for every other mitzvah.
He's taking that as a given. Now, what he's done is to establish a legal basis for violating a fast, as well as other halachos, for the sake of a fetus. Kedisha yishmor shabbasos harve. It's not about pikuach nefesh. This is not the same thing as pikuach nefesh. This is different. So to go back to Laser's question of, well then why don't I violate all the fasts? Why don't I say that she doesn't do any of them? The answer may well be, this isn't truly considered pikuach nefesh. Even though Kedisha Yishmor is one of the rationales for Pikuach Nefesh on Shabbos. I still have to come back to it more, but I think we've added a key piece here. There's still another piece that we need in order to get a more full picture. But this is a part of it.
This is pretty clear. You have a allowed to violate Shabbos in such cases, which we presume applies to all the fasts, Yom Kippur and the Tisha B'Av?
Maybe. I'm going with a maybe for now. We're going to come back to it. I needed to bring in this piece, and then there's another piece yet that we'll still need.
Are these really two separate issues?
What do you mean?
Pikuach nefesh and enjoying many Shabbatot. Is one part and parcel of the other?
Yes and no. The reason I say yes and no is because it doesn't mean that it's murder for a woman to fast and lose the kid. That's why I wouldn't go as far as that. Kadesh Yishmor suggests there's potential here for life, not that this is actually a viable life right now. I shouldn't use the word viable. Viable isn't the point. I wouldn't necessarily say this is a life. Right now, there is something which could evolve into a life. I mean, there's still one more piece that we need for this in order to really be able to answer it, so hold me to this. If I don't answer it, you know, bring me back on this. But this is a key element, I think. In practice, the Shmir Shabbos Kelchasa follows this statement of the Ramban. Take a look at source 16. Mechal in Shabbos l'shem hatzalas uber. We break Shabbos to save an uber. V'afilu u'pachos meraboyim yom. Even if it's under 40 days, that's his point. Okay. So, we've defined pregnancy now as any point within the pregnancy. This matters, by the way, in particular in IVF cases. Right? In many cases, you know, women aren't even aware for much of the first 40 days that they are pregnant. But in an IVF case where they actually know, this becomes very relevant. Okay. So we've answered what the concern is for the mother's health and the fetus's health. We've answered that pregnancy begins even before 40 days as far as this is concerned. What is the status of the fast itself? Well, Yom Kippur we know, right? Yom Kippur is a d'oraisa, that we're good with. I'm now going to take us to the other end of the fast before we do Tisha B'Av, because Tisha B'Av is really the problem case. The three Chorban-related fasts, okay? Shavuos Arba Tammuz, Asara B'Teves, Tzom Gedalia. Take a look at source 17. The Gemara asks a question there. Why don't we send out emissaries from the Beis Din to inform everybody of the status of the calendar in advance of these three fasts? I mean, some Gedalia is taken care of because we send out emissaries, Rosh Hashanah, everybody's supposed to find out when Rosh Hashanah is and therefore know when Tzom Gedalia is. It's the third of Tishrei. But we don't send out emissaries for Tammuz to let everybody know when Shavuos Arba Tammuz is. We don't send out emissaries for Teves to let everybody know when Asar Arba Teves is. And the Gemara says, why not? The Velifku Shluchim Nami at Tammuz V'Teves. I added in the word Shluchim there. Why don't these emissaries leave the Beis Din also for those months? After all, the Amar of Chana Bar Gvid Bar Bizna, Amar of Shimon Chasida, Maidich Siv, Koma Hashan Tzvakos, Tzom Arvid, Tzom HaChamishi, Tzom HaShvi, Tzom HaSiri, Yeh LeBeis Yehuda, LeSasun, LeSimcha. The Pasuk says, these fasts will be turned into days of joy. Kari Lehu Tzom, V'Kari Lehu Sasun V'Simcha. Why are you calling them Tzom, fasts, and saying that they are for celebration? So he says, "Bizman she'ish shalom yu l'sasan l'simcha." This is the answer of Shimon Chasida. When there is peace, those fasts become days of celebration. Hashem reversed our suffering and created celebration. Ein shalom, if there is no peace, then those are fasts. So in a time when we don't have shalom, everyone has to observe these fasts. So you should be sending people out to let everybody know what the date is. Amar of Papa, Chikei Amar Rav Papa said, this is the answer. Bizman sheyesh shalom, yiyu l'sasan u'l'simcha. When there is peace, they will be for sasan v'simcha, joy. Yesh shmad, when there are decrees against us trying to eliminate our Judaism. Then those are fasts, but then there's an intermediate period. Ein shmad. Vein shalom. We're not living under the Greeks or something. But on the other hand, we don't have the ability to worship in a Beis Hamikdash. Ratzu misanin, ratzu ein misanin. If you want, you can fast. If you want, you can choose not to fast. We, in our day, have accepted those as fasts. That's why the Shulchan Aruch used the language I pointed out earlier of Asur Lifrot Geder, that you can't break the fence on those. Everyone now has to do it. But he says, as far as we are concerned, in our day, meaning in the Gemara's day, you could, and you could choose not to. We're not living under such terrible decrees. I don't know exactly where in the Roman Empire they're living, but they're not under terrible decrees, based on other things that we know about what's going on at that point. But he says, they're optional. And therefore, you don't need to send out the emissaries. Well, then you shouldn't send out emissaries for the month of Av, because Tisha B'Av also doesn't need to be observed. So Amar Papa Sha'ani Tisha B'Av, how the Huchbulu Bot Saros. Rav Papa says Tisha B'Av is different because it was doubled in terms of the horrible things that happened on that day. We know the list of the five things. Grand Yeshiva Sefer Thomas also has five things, but Tosfos there. And Rosh Hashanah points out that it's not the same category. The five things of Tisha Sefer Thomas don't reach the level of the five of Tisha B'Av. So the three Churban related fasts are dependent on ratzu, on whether people want to or whether people do not want to. The Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, in source 18, brings a ruling on this then, based on the idea that these fasts were considered to be optional, that we accepted. The Kasva goes, Maimon Sharabenu Tam Hiter Leisha Yoledes Lecho Betzom Gedalia Afilo Achar Shiva. He quotes the Gedas Maimonios, commenting that Rabbeinu Tam permitted a woman who was pregnant to eat on some Gedalia. I'm sorry, not who was pregnant, who had given birth already, to eat on some Gedalia, even after the first week after her pregnancy, after the birth. And then he quotes the Gemara in Shabbos that says that that after 7 days we don't break Shabbos. And he says, how could it be? Nonetheless, it was permitted. They allowed her to eat on some Gedalia because, after all, Ratzu Misanin, Ratzu Ein Misanin. I'm starting to run here in the source only because I realize that we're already 45 minutes in. So the position of the Beis Yosef is that because it's an optional fast, you are able to do as you choose. If she's in this position, we let her eat. I shouldn't say as you choose. That's a little stronger than I wanted. Okay, so the three Churban related fasts are on a much lower level that we see. Tanis Esther is also on a lower level, as the Rambam writes in Source 19. The Nagu call Yisrael Bismanim Elulis Anos Bishlosha Asar Ba'adar. Our practice is that we fast on the 13th of Adar. There are different views as to what we are commemorating. Are we commemorating the fast of the Jews at the time? Are we commemorating the fast of the people who were going to go to war and they fasted as soldiers before going to war? But the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah, you use it here, and you see it here in Source 20 and in Source 21. Say that she does not need to fast. They aren't even within this. The fast doesn't apply to them. Got it? So Tanis Esther is on a lower level. What about Tisha B'Av? So Tisha B'Av is the complex piece that we need to get to, and it's the last of the really complex things that we need to note. We saw the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah already in Source 17, which said that Tisha B'Av is different from the others. Take a look at Source 22, Gemara in Megillah. Rabbi Lazar quotes Rabbi Chanina regarding certain practices that Rabbi tried to institute. One was Rabbi Natan Atiyah B'Purim. Rabbi planted trees on Purim. There was some debate as to whether you could do that. Rachatz B'Karona Shal Tzipori B'Shavah Sabbat Tammuz. He bathed in the bathhouse in Tzipori on the 17th of Tammuz, showing that the five Inuyim don't apply on Shavah Sabbat Tammuz. U'bikesh Lakor Tisha B'Av. And he wanted to uproot Tisha B'Av. And they said, you can't do that. Even if your name is Rabbi, you can't do that. To which the Rabbi Abba Bar Zavda says in horror, he says, that wasn't what he tried to do. He wasn't uprooting Tisha B'Av. How can you think that? Rather, it was a year when Tisha B'Av fell on Shabbos, and he felt, you don't observe it. It doesn't get pushed to Sunday. You simply don't observe it in a year when Tisha B'Av is a nidcha, is pushed off. That's the Gemara in Megillah. Take a look at Source 23. I'm going to tie all these things together in a moment. Source 23, Shmuel says, Ein tanis tzibur v'bavel ela tish'a ba'av bilvad. There's no such thing as a fast day in Bavel, only Tisha B'Av. And Rashi explains in Source 24, he means we don't decree fasts. To say that you have to stop eating the day during the day and the fast starts that night, to have all of these stringencies like Yom Kippur, only Tisha B'Av. Okay, what does all of this mean? What are we bringing here with the Gemara first, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah about accepting the fasts and Tisha B'Av being special, and then Rebbe's possible attempt to eliminate Tisha B'Av? What exactly is this all about? There are two schools of thought. One school of thought is taken by the Tashbates, others attribute it to Rabbeinu Hanan, although I didn't think Rabbeinu Hanan's language was as clear as all that. But the Tashbates says in source 25, "B'tishah ba'av shuchblu botzaros, ratzu v'kiblu alayim oso tzom." The Jews chose to accept that Beth Bichum Rosav with all of its stringencies. It is a fast even when we're not suffering because we accepted it. Got it? Because we accepted it. That's key. The other school of thought is represented by Tosfos in source 26. And the position that Tosfos takes there, you can take a look at inside and see it, is that it's considered obligatory because of the troubles that occurred on that day. It's not that we accepted it. It's a requirement, automatically, for us to observe Tisha B'Av. That's a very different view. And one of the practical applications is the case of the pregnant woman. You see, the reason why we were so easy on her when it came to the three other fasts is because those were accepted by popular acclaim, and they were never accepted for women who were pregnant. There was never a practice that pregnant women would fast on those days. It wasn't part of the minhag. Our practice of fasting on Tisha B'Av didn't include pregnant women. Whereas, if Tisha B'Av is unique, it's not about a minhag, but it's simply the law, you have to fast, then pregnant women are included in that as well. It depends on how I understand Tisha B'Av. Was Tisha B'Av something that we accepted? Pregnant women are exempt. They don't have to be in pain. They don't have to be suffering or in danger or anything else. That's one way. Or is it like Yom Kippur, it's an obligatory fast, and then women who are pregnant are indeed responsible to observe the day, barring any sort of pain or danger? That's that's exactly our question. What is the nature of the fast? I brought you sources like this. In source 27, I brought you a Taz. In source 28, I brought you a Rashba, who expressed this. I'll take a look quickly at the Rashba in 28, just to show it to you. He says, "Mistabra de ein ze mevatel de rebeisin chavero." He's talking about Rebbe's initiative to nullify Tisha B'Av, and he says that wouldn't be called nullifying the act of another beisin. Why? There shouldn't He says Tisha B'Av initially was something that we accepted conditionally. When there's trouble, then we are going to observe it. Right? We chose to accept it. It's our minhag. That's why Rebbe is okay trying to nullify it according to the Havamina of the Gemara, the initial assumption that that's actually what he's trying to do. So the Rashba takes the position that it's just something that we accepted. That's the idea. On the other hand, the Taz's view in 27 was actually that it's a chov, it's an obligation. You don't have the option of playing with it at all. So, what we've seen then is that when it comes to Yom Kippur, we have a clear-cut obligation. When you deal with the three lower Churban-related fasts, as well as Tanis Esther, it's something we accepted, and therefore pregnant women should be exempt entirely. Tisha B'Av, it depends on how I view it. Is it obligatory, or is it something that we actually accepted upon ourselves, and it became an obligation that in that way? So what do we do in practice? What happens? So for Yom Kippur, the general rule is that women are supposed to fast. Take a look at source 29, Rabbi Avram Sofer Avram and his Nishmas Avram. He says, "Kolz man she margisha asma beria chayeves latzum." If she feels healthy, she's obligated to fast. V'lo tocha v'lo tishta, she shouldn't eat, she shouldn't drink. Afilu im tetzarech lishka v'meshach kol yom ha-kippurim v'lo tuchal aleches lebeis ha-knesses. Even if that means she's going to have to lie down all Yom Kippur and not go to shul, that's okay. Utzricha ha-isha meuberes lahaschil lishtos berege sheyesh latzirei leida sidirim. However, as soon as she has regular contractions, she must drink. He says, "Kadesh lo tikanes alei de b'matzav shel choser noz lim," lest she enter labor in a dehydrated state. Right? Then we have a unique concern. If she enters labor dehydrated, that's a separate concern. And then he says, Yadua, Sha'isha Shaharsa Ba'open TV. It is known that if a woman became pregnant, she conceived normally, meaning as opposed to IVF, then Yom Kippur does not raise concerns of preterm labor, ola hapala, or of a stillbirth, except for preterm labor in the ninth month, which doesn't have any meaning. He's taking that view that that the ninth month is not really an issue. So that's the position that he takes. He says, better to lie in bed. Rav Shlomo Zalman says that here it's in source 30, sorry.
What do you think he means when he says it's a natural? Is he suggesting that if it's an IVF?
Yeah, IVF, he changes his guidance in terms of early on and concern for potential problems.
Specifically within the first 40 days, or, you know...
Right, so I'd have to go back and take a look, but I think... I remember it specifically being early on in the pregnancy. I don't remember it well enough to quote it.
Very, very early on.
Yeah.
And otherwise, fourth month, I can't imagine it would be a difference.
Yeah, no, I think he was specifically talking about very early on, but again, I'm afraid of quoting it wrong. The Rosh Shlomo Zalman says if she goes into labor, she should drink even more than the shear. She shouldn't sit there and say, well, you know, let me drink the minimal amount. She should drink for real. That's a Yom Kippur statement. What about Tisha B'Av? So for Tisha B'Av, we already saw the Shulchan Aruch's ruling. The Shulchan Aruch said that they are supposed to fast. He rules that it's a matter of Tisha B'Av being an obligation, like the view of the Taz, not like the view of the Rashba. What if they feel weak? So the Nishmas Avram is in source 30. One who is weak doesn't even need to worry about eating less than a shear on Tisha B'Av. But someone who is healthy and is only concerned that they might become ill, there's a plague in the city and they're worried about their nutrition, or a woman who is pregnant, who is feeling weak, she's worried about becoming sick, they should eat less than the shear. That's his advice for a pregnant woman on Tisha B'Av who is feeling weak. What if she feels ill? Then we have our Ramban in the Taras HaAdam who says that she should not fast. And the Mishnah Berurah that we saw who applied it to a pregnant woman who has vomiting, headache, weakness, or similar ailment. So to go back now and answer the question of why are we distinguishing between the different levels of fasts, the answer is that if I believe, as the Shulchan Aruch seems to, that Tisha B'Av is obligatory, I need some indication. That isn't the class next door, so I'm bang on the wall. There is some indication that she is... You need some indication that she is in danger, the fetus is in danger, in order to justify breaking the fast. That's the idea. It is not a given that fasting is going to harm the child. It is not a given that fasting is going to harm her. You need the indication first. Once we have the indication, then we override the fast.
That also applies to Yom Kippur.
That also applies to Yom Kippur. Yes, it also applies to Yom Kippur. That's correct.
Eating shiurim is a Tisha B'Av thing?
So, according to this, it does count on Tisha B'Av as well, yes, as a possibility. Yeah, until you know that there's a real issue. Yeah. Until you know that there's a real issue. What about the other fasts? So we already said that pregnant women are exempt. However, there's a nuance in the language. Take a look at source 31, the Beis Yosef. Rabbi Yosef Karo, in his commentary to the Tur, says one thing. In his Shulchan Aruch, he says something different. He says in his commentary to the Tur about the other fasts, "Umashma b'divrei Agos Maimon, delo shari lechol ubros umenikos b'shloshat somos hacherim," that they are not allowed to eat on the three fasts, quotes Agos Mamonios, "LMK nahayu mitzdaros," unless they are in pain. That's Agos Mamonios. And then, Abu Rabbeinu Tam Kasav, the Rabbi Yeruchim Kasav, I should say, he quotes Rabbi Yeruchim, who we already saw. B'shem Agaonim, Uberes, Asura Lehis Anos, Zula Si B'tishra Rav Yom HaKippur, Mishum Tzar Havlad, that they're not allowed to fast. And he leaves it at that. The assumption in general by the postgame is that he's actually following Rabbi Yeruchim. When his language here indicates that he wants to follow Rabbi Yeruchim, and therefore a pregnant woman who wants to fast on Shavuot Tamuz is told, no, you may not. You must eat.
However, in his Shulchan Aruch, that's not what he says. He says in 32, Ubros Omenikos Misanos Petishbav Kederach Shemisanos Umashlimos Biyom Kippur, Abel Begimel Samasacherim Peturos Milihis Anos. They are exempt from fasting on the other three ones. Right? Exempt. Exempt means you can, or you can choose not to. So which is it? How do we resolve Beis Yosef versus the Shulchan Aruch? So there are some who say, yeah, he recanted in the Shulchan Aruch. But Rav Chalfon Moshe Cohen, in his Tshuva Shaul V'Nishal, argues that that he did not recant and that we follow Yireinu Yeruchim. And he brings you eight reasons, which I gave you headings for in Source 33. I wasn't going to bring you the entire Tshuva here on the sheet. He gives you eight reasons that we should follow Yireinu Yeruchim. Number one, he says, Hagos Hamanio said they are putter. In the Shulchan Aruch, he said they're putter. That doesn't mean he's really saying they can fast. Whereas Yireinu Yeruchim said explicitly, Asur. They're not allowed to fast. The language is stronger in Rabbeinu Yeruchim. That's number one. Number two, Rabbeinu Yeruchim is from the Gaonim. That gives it a certain strength to it, which Hagos Hamanio's position, quoted in the Beis Yosef, does not have. He's a Rishon. Number three, it's an issue of fetal survival. This is Safek Nefashos. So he's willing to treat this Chalil Shabbos Achas as a Pikuach Nefesh mandate. Number four, he says, not just the fact that Hagos Mamanios indicates permission, but he says Peturos doesn't necessarily mean, in the Shulchan Aruch language, that you're allowed to fast. Number five, he says, the Beis Yosef never explicitly recanted. He never explicitly said, I've changed my mind. Number six, if he had agreed with Hagos Mamanios, then his wording in the Shulchan Aruch would have said, they're potter only when they're in great pain. He didn't say that. He just said Peturos. If he took the position of Hagos Hamanios, he would have said potter when they're in great pain. Number seven, he expected you to look in the Beis Yosef for the details. And number eight, he says it's logical. Once you're potter from fasting, you can't be allowed to harm the kid. He said, just like Beis Yosef writes regarding optional fasts, go back to your question, right? He says regarding optional fasts that pregnant women are not allowed to take on the fasts for rain just because they want to. So too, they're not allowed to take this on. Once you're exempt, you're not allowed to. It's a case of being mekel on pikuach nefesh. You can't do that. That's his position. What does the Ramah say? So the Ramah says that pregnant women who are in great pain need not fast on the minor three, although they customarily are strict. He follows the view of Hagos Mamanios very clearly. What is he going to do with the view of Rabbeinu Yeruchim, who said that they're not allowed to? So it could be that he's saying those who have a minhag of fasting, in fact, should be strict and should fast. Rav Avadi Yosef crossed the line and decided to add something in his tshuva on the matter for Ashkenazim in Source 35. First of all, Source 34, the Mishnah Berurah says that pregnant women are weak, they should not fast. But in Source 35, Rav Avadi Yosef said, even Ashkenazi women who normally follow the Ramah should be lenient. He says there's room for them to be lenient because today people aren't that healthy. People are used to a more substantive diet. They don't fast as well. And therefore, even Ashkenazi women are automatically considered to be weak. And therefore, they should follow the view of the Beis Yosef and they should not fast. That was his decision on it. So again, just to provide a quick summary, I'm not going to summarize the medical because you can see the papers that I listed on there, and do better research on that. In any case. But in terms of the general overall issue, we are concerned about her health, both in terms of illness and in terms of pain. We are concerned about the health of the fetus. We are somewhat concerned for preterm labor, but not in the ninth month. We define pregnancy as being at any point within the pregnancy, even before 40 days, based on that Ramban. It's so ruled the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa. We consider Yom Kippur to be something you don't break unless you absolutely have to. The three Churban-related fasts, on the other hand, the three lesser Churban-related fasts, we say that it's optional at best. Some would rule that it's prohibited for them to fast. Others would say they can fast if that's their minhag, but if they feel weak, then they must break it. Tanis Esther is in that category as well, because it's something that's nohagu, something that people are accustomed to do. And Tisha B'Av is a subject to this machlokes, to this debate about how we view it. And in practice, we tend to rule strictly for Tisha B'Av that yes, they should try to do the fast, but if they feel weak, then indeed they should eat. As always, and as I said at the beginning, for all practical...
Whoops. Just the time.
Yeah, no, but it's important to reiterate and get it on the video that for all practical questions, as I said at the start, please make sure to ask your shul rav. Thank you very much.
I want to come back to that point. I'm not sure I understand. No. Two things. One is philosophical. One is practical. Halachic. If God says I'm going to ask you to fast on Yom Kippur,
yeah.
And